Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Last week you may have tuned into or even been part of our live edition of the show where we posed the question, is London still the cultural capital of the world? There was plenty to cram into our 30-minute slot, and so today we're going to pick up on one of the points we didn't have a lot of time to go into on last week's show, and that's gentrification. It's a topic that gets talked about a lot, especially here on Monocle 24, and on today's show we want to discuss the relationship between the arts and regenerated neighbourhoods. It's a chicken and egg type scenario. What comes first to a gentrified area, the developers or the artists? We've reported from places that seem to have done it both ways over the past year. We met a developer who transformed Miami's Little River area into a thriving pit stop off the Biscayne Boulevard for arty types and young entrepreneurs. We've been to the British seaside town of Margate, whose low rents have attracted a wave of creatives, giving the town a much-needed lick of fresh paint. On today's show, we'll be going between London, Madrid and Belgrade to answer the question, are the arts responsible for gentrification? That's all ahead on Culture with me, Robert Bounds. We're going to begin things in Spain to look at how an area can transform itself when the right people move in. Reina Sofía is arguably one of Spain's most important modern art galleries. When it opened in an old palace back in 1992, the area was given an undeniable boost, but the true transformation of the surrounding streets came at the hands of a clutch of independent gallerists. Our correspondent, Liam Aldous, took a stroll along Dr. Forquet Street, which has inadvertently become Madrid's thriving hub for independent art, and it didn't take a multi-million euro taxpayer-funded grand master plan to get it off the ground.
On the edge of Madrid's colourful historical centre and in the shadow of the Atocha station, a triangle of modern art museums attract wide-eyed art aficionados in the thousands. The Reina Sofía, with its Picassos, Dalís and Miros, remind every person walking its halls why Spanish works occupy prime wall space around the world. But two other galleries, La Casa Encendida and the Tabacalera, are also both primary organs of the city's dynamic art scene. Behind all three sits the once dilapidated district of Lavapiés, an area which, thanks to the foresight of some intrepid independent gallerists, has become one of Spain's preeminent modern art hubs.
I'm Victoria Lozano. I'm working as director in Galería Bacelos in Madrid.
I step inside what was once an old plumber supplies shop to what is now Galería Bacelos, and Victoria is quick to set the record straight about the second coming of Calle Dr. Forquet. After the inauguration of the Reina Sofía in 1992, she tells me, one of Spain's most insatiable collectors and gallerists, Elga Alviar, opened her own gallery here in 1995. It wasn't long until her peers in the industry, many of them from other parts of Spain, started following suit.
This kind of places where you can see contemporary art but are not strictly a serious museum when you have to speak slow and
so here you can be fun, you can speak loud like in your gallery. Yeah. So there's no rules here, that we're saying.
We hope everybody's here, and now we have an organization, so it's the DF, Dr. Forquet, and we tried to open together and have the same exhibitions, like five for a year or this kind, because that helps. It's a place where you can to visit 15 galleries at the same time, so it's fine, because in 1 hour or 2 hours you can see all the exhibitions of this street.
I step outside onto the sunny pavement, and the dividends of this stronger together approach are instantly apparent. September marks the beginning of Madrid's art calendar, and the galleries along this strip are clearly benefiting from pooling their resources together. In just a few short paces, I find the Nogueras Blanchard Gallery, where Brazilian Tiago de Abreu Pinto is manning the weekend desk.
We are here trying to show the new, what's being done, you know, at this right moment. You can discover new artists. Most of them are really interesting. Most of the galleries here are galleries which are part of art fairs, international art fairs, and have their artists in as well, being part of of international biennials and museum exhibitions. So it's a way to discover new artists and maybe, why not, a new Picasso. I think it's an experiment that we did, and it really worked pretty well. This street brought people together for sure, and I hope this carries on like this.
As I continue down Dr. Fourquette, several other DIY initiatives, old walls embellished by detailed street art, and an abandoned lot being tiled by urban gardeners, cast this brand of gentrification in a more positive light. Add the 15 galleries to the mix, and what you have is a microcosm for Madrid's resilient collaborative spirit, which continues to serve the city well during the national economic malaise.
The business is really good, and this is a really dynamic place, the Dr. Fourquette Street, because we are in this moment 14 galleries that are working together in the openings and the closing of the exhibitions.
Esther Ameda is gearing up to close the renowned Moisés Pérez de Albañez Gallery for the afternoon, but kindly stops to reaffirm why this particular street is in such high spirits.
We are not alone in this place.
You're not fighting each other, right? Is that kind of interesting for you, working in the art sector, seeing the spirit of collaboration where the galleries are working together?
It's really good. It's really good because you're not alone ever, and you have a good relationship with all the galleries that works in this street.
You got a lot of people walking past and looking in the window and coming in as well. Lots of foreigners as well. That's a good thing, right?
Yeah, it's a good thing because it's Saturday and we are in an art fair now, so people are like, I want to see the gallery and then
there's
go
some more
to
people.
Madero. There's more people here.
Not too long ago, Madrileños considered this to be a dangerous crime-filled no-go zone, known more for its inherent risks than its risky artists. Fortunately, the new foot traffic has reinvigorated the barrio. Food and retail is still predominantly independent, and residents are happily soaking up the sun on the pavement terraces. This successful, almost accidental experiment required no grandmaster plan, visionary tycoon, or colossal contribution from the public purse. The secret? Nothing too tricky, just a straightforward natural recipe of cooperation, communication, and community values, all of which are on full display both inside and outside the exhibition spaces. For Monocle in Madrid, I'm Liam Aldous.
Thank you, Liam. Now, over in Belgrade, we're going to go to the other extreme, an area that's maybe been over-gentrified. Serbia's capital has been fertile ground for creative types and cultural organisations. There are plenty of empty buildings, many of them relics of the Yugoslav era, and the rents are low. These are the conditions which allowed the city's Savamala district to grow organically into one of Southeast Europe's most celebrated cultural hubs, where artisans and architects are neighbours with galleries and gig venues. But now all of that is under threat because of the massive Belgrade waterfront development. This Gulf-funded mega project proposes replacing inner-city grit with shiny tower blocks and high-end housing and retail. And Savamala's creatives are wondering what will be left for them. Our Belgrade correspondent, Guy Delaunay, went to the multi-purpose cultural space Mixer House and spoke to its creative director, Maja Lalic.
Creative people, especially with the artistic provenance, have been able to see the beauty in unattractive surfaces and to see opportunities where they're not too obvious. If you saw Savamala maybe 10 years ago, you would probably, of course, also think that it needed a life because it was really a very sad place without any kind of activity, with a lot of locked spaces. So when artistic collective started to actually unlock this and actually present to the public some crazy, fantastic, inspiring environments here, which are of course always refurbished with a lot of energy, creativeness, and with a little money, almost none. That's a very strong suggestion that we don't have to have always millions to be able to make some kind of regeneration of dying parts of the city.
For people who haven't been here, what's the atmosphere like in Savamala during the day, during the night? I mean, I imagine there's two quite distinct atmospheres.
We've managed to create this kind of collaborative atmosphere between all these different organizations. We even made some different festivals together. And when we organize our signature festival, Mixer Festival, we include almost everyone in the neighborhood. From private garden parties of the people who live next door to existing cafes and shops and local crafts. We're using the festival to basically also reveal some of these authentic values of that area.
You built this creative quarter, if you like, organically from the ground up. You've interacted with the local community, people who've lived here for decades. Now, all of a sudden, this massive project, Belgrade Waterfront, the biggest building project in Southeast Europe, the biggest thing that's happened to Belgrade since the Second World War, is surely putting everything that you've built here organically, everything that's grown here, under threat. What sort of changes are you seeing happening?
First of all, we see the lack of this enthusiastic energy, because of course, if you have the coolest place, like a little cultural hub, creating a lot of different very valuable programs and for the art scene and for the local area, and overnight your rent doubles. I mean, what can you do, really? Just leave.
Can it survive? Can Savamala survive?
Well, Savamala will survive because Savamala always survived. I mean, we consider ourselves nomads. If we live here, it will be multiple reasons, basically. One is that it no longer will have the same atmosphere and energy as we helped create it at the beginning. Two, economically, it will probably be beyond our reach. And three, it's also this kind of an evolution that we actually have for ourselves. So every 3 or 4 years, it's something else that happens, you know. We cannot sit too long in this limbo. We say it here, ja ili bu, like it has to be something needs to be done.
That was Guy Delaunay reporting from Belgrade, and it's at this point in the show where things get a little fuzzy as we look at the role of the developer. We've just heard from a place where city planners are taking an area that's rebuilt itself to nurture creativity and going into overkill, hiking up rents and attracting a richer crowd to live in characterless new builds and monotonous rows of shiny towers. So what makes a good developer? And should they be patrons of the arts too? We're going to take a wander down to a newly revamped neighbourhood in London shortly, but first we're going to hear the thoughts of Richard Upton on the matter. He's the Deputy Chief Executive of UNI PLC, a property company renowned for their work on community regeneration projects and as a major supporter of the arts.
To a great degree, actually, we really do work with arts and culture industries at a grassroots level on almost every single project that we have. They're a key part of our brief. They're a reference point there. Very capable people that are rooted to a particular area and have very open minds, and therefore when we are suggesting change and transformation, they're very productive in how they can approach those questions and very often transform difficult places into very interesting places. It's happened over centuries that the arts and creative industries have been at the front end of change and regeneration. Art and culture as a patronage in development is important, but not just as a sculpture on a plinth. It's an integral part of the brief. It's an integral part of place. And responsible developers really should embrace the arts industries as a key stakeholder, not just an add-on.
As Richard Upton says, it's not just about sticking a few bits of public art and statues around a square. It's thinking about the ways that people will think and be creative within the space they live in for years to come. And with that in mind, we're now going to trot off to King's Cross. The area around King's Cross Station has long been in development. What was a goods yard and then a no-go area, and for a while a checkpoint for alighting from the Eurostar that hurried you through as quickly as possible, is fast becoming a destination that you might just want to stop and spend some time in. The people behind this are Argent, a big developer with a suitably grand plan. They've repurposed many of those old buildings. Their address is on Stable Street, but there aren't a lot of horses anymore, like any. Of course, there's residential and there's retail, lots of that. But what of culture? Luckily, one of the King's Cross Granary Square's first tenants was the none more creative Central St Martin's School of Art. So that helps. I spoke to their project director for retail, Craig White, to see how you mix selling sneakers with seeing bands. And we went for a walk, and there's a warning. There may be banging in the background of this report.
When we started creating the retail strategy, we had this bit of fun where we imagined what it would smell like and sound like around here. When it was the industrial heartland of London, you know, the powerhouse of the Victorian Empire. So all the goods came down from the north and they basically terminated here. So whether it was coal, grain, meat, fish, it all happened here. And obviously there was a community around that, like all communities. Culture and art and music is right at the heart of that. And certainly with the canals, you know, when you look at the history of the culture of the canals and the travel that that brought in, similar to like where the goods came from. I mean, these goods came from the northeast, like coal. And if you look at, you know, my family are coal miners from north of Newcastle, the history of music and art and expression of people that otherwise couldn't express themselves, maybe politically, is really, really powerful. So it was already here. So we looked at the history, and then we looked at the sort of more recent history as well, which was the music scene, that organic kind of, you know, the bits that people moved to, were forced to in London when they couldn't go to the more central places. So King's Cross became, you know, the sort of centre of clubbing in London.
That's we're kind of spitting distance from the Scala still, aren't we, here? But it's one of those things people say, but, you know, gentrification and development, that's what kind of, you concrete over the culture to build something new. Now, we're not saying that King's Cross right here, people were dancing in the goods yard, exactly, and going to gigs in the coal store. But do you see it as a challenge to get culture into a place like this and to sort of have it cheek by jowl with retail spaces and residential spaces?
I think the challenge is creating something that's authentic, because I think you can, you know, we could try and recreate something, but that's all you're doing. You're just recreating it for the sake of recreating. They were here because there was a purpose of them being here. There were empty spaces, there were big spaces. You know, it was a really vibrant scene and they could get on with it. Whereas if we tried to recreate that, it wouldn't be the same. So what we're trying to do here is bring things that are relevant to the people that are coming in and already here, the communities around us. You know, we've got 82 languages spoken around the site. And there are, you know, there's some great touch points here. So Tile Yard, just up the road, which is our neighbours, that's been there for the last sort of, you know, 10 years, slowly evolving.
These are studios, and yeah, Anthony Gormley's got his
music studio. Recording studio in Europe. So they've got 73 studios. Anthony Gormley's got his studio up there as well. Rafa, the performance cycling company, have actually moved their offices up there as well. So there's a lot of great things around, you know, whether it's the Wellcome Trust and the programs they do, the British Library, Gargosian Gallery, or whether it's just a bit more, you know, coming up from the underground, which is Central St Martin's and the things they do, you know. So we're not trying to recreate that, but we hope we're providing space, whether it's public space. You know, 40% of the site is public space. And we really encourage that kind of arts, creative community coming in, and also the businesses that are around it. But you also mentioned, you know, retail as well. Retail's converge. It's not just one thing anymore. So retailers are inspired by music and art and creativity, and they build that into their stores. So it's not just one thing anymore. It's this convergence. And so part of our mission is to provide a home for these brands that can do that convergence.
We did a show last week where we had people talking about how culture can bring regeneration, and regeneration can sometimes bring culture. Sometimes people feel like it's one way round more than the other. I know that you're going to be putting some sort of more performance spaces in here into King's Cross and all the rest of it. How do you kind of do that? Do you test it out? Is it a bit of a build it and they will come mentality? Or how can you sort of engineer, and how can you make it known that these spaces exist and that people should feel relaxed, should be buying a drink, and should be, frankly, cutting some rug?
Yeah, I mean, you've got to remember that 20 years ago, you probably locked your door when you drove through King's Cross. So what we're dealing with here is taking a huge bit of the city, former goods yards, that it, you know, its purpose was industrial, and then you mix in the kind of clubbing and the sort of, you know, less salubrious kind of sides of city life, and that perception and the fact that it doesn't exist. So to engineer it, as you call it, or to create a place, then you have to raise the profile, and an arts program and an enlivenment program and an engagement program is a great way to do that, to start introducing people to an area. And then as you bring on different aspects of that mixed-use place, whether it's the offices or the kind of leisure side of things or the academic, and certainly in my case, the retail and restaurants, then you just start to introduce kind of programs that are relevant to that.
And as the retail director here at Argent, people will know what that means, you know, deciding which shops go in which spots, I suppose, in layman's terms. How much of this stuff is serendipity? And how much can you engineer that sort of happy accident? Because people don't want to feel that they are walking into an engineered environment where there's a bit of this and a bit of that. And people don't want to know that they're in a zone. They just want to feel that they're walking down the street and they might want to buy something, or they might want to have a beer in here. It's a tough one when you've got the responsibility for such a large space like this and you have shareholders to satisfy and all the rest of it. But how do you make it seem like it's an accident?
I think serendipity is a mild obsession that we had. It started off as a conversation like 6 years ago, saying, oh, that must have been serendipity, how that happened. But actually the reality is it's about friends of friends. And so, you know, as a developer, we sort of take the view, and have always taken the view, that we don't build a neighbourhood. You know, we physically build buildings and streetscapes and parks. But actually, our real skill in terms of whatever word you want to choose, whether it's curation or retail strategy and picking brands, the real skill is bringing people together that are of a kindred spirit and have a really nice ethos and values that reflect the kind of values that we're trying to recreate. So Spiritland is a great example of that. They'll come with their friends, and they'll have friends that work in other industries that want to be around them. So suddenly you start to build a community of shopkeepers, and you can watch it. You know, you can watch it at 6 p.m. and everyone's outside their shops, either having a cigarette or a glass of wine, just talking about the day.
What do you see as a kind of sign of success when you wander around here? Is it when you come here and you have your morning coffee, or is it when you maybe go next door to Spiritland? We're going to go and see Paul at Spiritland in a minute. Is it when you're wandering around there and you can come here and you can have a nice plate of charcuterie and a few glasses of Shiraz at midnight?
I think measures of success or signs of success. I think when you see these places occupied by such a broad mix of people using them for various things throughout the day, that's rewarding. A sign of success, I think, is probably better judged by the actual operators themselves. So, you know, before when we pick brands, we say to other operators, what do you think to these guys? Do they work with you? And do you think what they do is real?
A bit of a members club element to it.
Yeah, I mean, a members club would probably indicate that it was a closed shop, and it really isn't.
So no one gets blackballed. No,
exactly, yeah. This is a really open process. But what we're trying to achieve is authenticity. And quite a lot these days, there's a lot of brands that claim a lot of authenticity. But authenticity is a very difficult thing to identify. And I think one of the measures of success that we've always said is, if a brand director or a creative came here and actually walked around and it made them smile quietly, that this was an authentic place and a real place. Not just a cut and paste part of the city, you know, that we'd, because we're starting from scratch, we could look at cool magazines or whatever and say, actually, it'd be nice to have a bit of that. This is relevant. And so, again, coming back to the end user, that's authenticity for us. And I think that would be our measure of success.
Thanks, Craig. So what of the tenants? A brand new one in this cultural sphere is Spiritland. Is it a bar? Is it a restaurant? Is it a club? In fact, perhaps it's best described as a venue for recorded music, centred around a hi-fi system seemingly made by NASA, only better, and some 6-foot made-to-measure speakers. I spoke to the founder, Paul Noble.
What we're doing is a mix of several things. It's a cafe during the day, it's a bar in the evening. There's a strong retail element, so we're selling headphones, players, records, books, magazines, and there's also a content edge to it. So there's a radio studio, which is fitted out to the same standard as the rest of the equipment going on outside. And at the centre of it is the music, and putting as much love back into the music and the listening experience as possible.
There is something of the nighttime, the nightclub, the jazz club to it. It seems like a very convivial space. Now, I asked Craig White this next door at Argent about putting together the whole of the King's Cross project, how you engineer serendipity into it, how you make it feel like an accident. How do you hope that people will enjoy Spiritland? Can you welcome people on dates and make them successes just by sticking on a record? I suppose that's part and parcel of the effort here.
I mean, I would hope so. We've already had a Spiritland engagement, which is massively gratifying. A couple who met at our previous venue in Shoreditch just got engaged, so we obviously sent over bottles of champagne as soon as we heard the news. There's a few watchwords in our head: elegant, indulgent, relaxing. We're trying to make a space where you can really put the music to the fore and everything else complements that. So the lighting, the food and drink, it's all just there to be enjoyed. You know, you won't be going to the bar waving a £10 note, trying to get someone's attention. All of that's taken care of. It's table service, so it all comes to you. And we give the DJs a very open musical brief. So there's no dance floor, it's all seated. So there's never the tyranny of getting people up and going. And that means musically, you can go all the way, you know, as deeply into your private interests as possible, if that's flamenco or dub reggae. Or...
Oh, you read my mind.
Yeah, there you go. Flamenco dub. Come and play here. Or, you know, soundtracks, ambient music, some of the deeper electronic music.
And we're asking on this show if culture leads to gentrification, or sometimes whether it's the other way around. And I think most people feel that the cards are stacked one way in that conversation, and that culture always leads to gentrification. And we've been walking around this development in King's Cross. There's a lot of old buildings that have been repurposed, and there's a lot of big name brands in here. And then there's brand new concepts like yours here, Paul, like Spiritland. How do you sort of see your role in this kind of quite heady mix of retail and very expensive real estate? Do you think you kind of have a job here, a kind of trendy job, or does it just feel like it's quite organic and that people can swing by and find you by accident?
There's a few things. First of all, we've worked quite closely with Argent, and they've been really clever and very subtle inviting in an interesting and quite unexpected mix of brands. If they brought in all the usual suspects, it would just be a shopping centre. There's no reason for anyone to come here. We've got just over 2,000 square feet on a lovely luxury retail street. I'm sure there was plenty of other competition and a lot of larger and more well-established names who would like to be here doing something similar to what we're doing. The reality is we're doing something which is very distinctive and quite esoteric and not for everyone. It's approachable, but it's also niche. And it takes quite a forward-thinking imagination and retail sensibility to say, we're going to put Spiritland in there to open something which may not appeal to everyone, but appeals to a very interesting group of people. I mean, secondly, I'm from North London, and I grew up here raving at Bagley's studio just over the road. So seeing what's happened to King's Cross and being involved in bringing back some musical culture to the area is incredibly exciting, and I'm really honoured to put my little piece into that.
And just finally, Paul, then at 6 o'clock this evening, you're going to drop the needle on another record, listen to it in its entirety. It feels like the time the evening starts. It's also kind of cocktail hour, isn't it, in a traditional sense. What's tonight's record?
So at 6 o'clock, we like to break out the aperitivo and have some kind of strong drink and a little nibble to get the evening going. So we're going to play Gino Vannelli, Brother to Brother, sort of jazz fusion from 1978, big hair, tight jeans. I think you'll like it.
It's tough to focus when the music's that good. And the cocktails. So, are the arts responsible for gentrification? Under normal circumstances, they move on to the next place and the next and the next. And if you're building something new and hoping people might want to spend some money, be sure to engineer some artistry into the offering. You can pretend it's all a happy accident, but it won't be. But then show me a gallery owner and I'll show you someone with an empire in their head too. That brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Culture, and talking of gentrification, my producer was Holly Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tuning in.